21. A boat ride. Jordan supposed she could do a boat ride, although she had to admit she was disappointed. It was very civilized, very pretty. They'd gotten to Boston Harbor an hour or so before dark as the sky glowed orange behind the Boston skyline of skyscrapers and clock towers. The icy water lapped darkly against tour boats drowsing at the wharf. The sailboats that were still out this late in the year lay gracefully on the water, their plumage lowered and only bones remaining. As habit, Jordan thought about how she would paint her surroundings, which brush she would use to draw those fine, fine hairs of rigging etched delicately against the sky. But it was a bit of a dull exercise. It was too obvious a scene, chosen by too many artists and photographers over the years, because it was pretty. Pretty was good, she told herself. Nice was good. Just a little disappointing.
Matthew, actually buckle that life vest. Actually buckle it, Declan said.
He looked quite at home here on the water, quite at home here in Boston altogether. A handsome Irish-American fellow with a head of tamed curls and those narrow, squinted eyes of a Celt. Collared shirt, nice sweater, good jacket, all of a piece with the pretty skyline and the boat and the water. Hennessy would hate him so much, Jordan thought. Congratulations, she'd say. You've found boring white man number 314. A date in Boston Harbor would only underline Hennessy's point, because it was nice, because it was pretty, because you could read about it on the tourism site and purchase tickets, because it was a thing everyone might like. How romantic, Hennessy's voice would drip with judgment. Jordan had to make do with imagining Hennessy's voice since she hadn't called. Why hadn't she called? Jordan knew she was alive and well because Ronan had called Declan. Well, and because Jordan was still standing. Silence from Hennessy was as worrisome as words.
How do you know I wasn't made to float? Matthew was saying petulantly.
Mother Mary, Declan said with exasperation, do we have to do this every day? Just say you want a therapist for your birthday.
Do you still call it a birthday if it's the day you just, like, appeared? Matthew asked.
Jordan contemplated inserting herself into this discussion, but decided it was more about brothers than it was about the dreaming. She knew more about one of these things than the other.
Everyone just appears at some point, Matthew, Declan said, removing the last of the line, securing them to the pier.
Jordan, are you tied down?
She saluted him. They were off. The engine drowned out the protests of the seagulls overhead and the voices of pedestrians on the wharf they left behind. The water chopped up white and gray and black behind them. The Atlantic Ocean hissed cold winter wind from the darkening horizon. It wasn't entirely civilized, Jordan supposed, because the temperature was too wild, and Declan drove the boat a little too fast across the waves for romantic sightseeing. Why did Jordan care what Hennessy would think anyway? She didn't, actually. She just missed her. While Matthew huddled on the back of the boat with a bag of potato chips, Jordan eventually got tired of the chill and joined Declan at the wheel behind the relative protection of the windshield.
Where did you learn to drive a boat?
Jordan asked, voice raised to be heard. It would be easier to talk if he cut the engine, but he seemed intent on a destination, clipping past various wharfs and frequently glancing over his shoulder to get his bearings.
Your father?
Declan laughed.
A senator I work for taught me. He said it was a life skill. Zombie apocalypse. Fundraising opportunities. Same difference.
Declan smiled thinly at the ocean.
It's that catch-22 of money. People feel better about donating money to people who already have it. Did you find anything out today?
For weeks, Jordan had been throwing herself against the question of sweet metals.
She returned to El Haleo again and again, trying to understand the rules of it, how far its influence extended, if it varied from day to day, how it did what it did. It wasn't the only sergeant she visited either. She tracked down as many sergeants as she could to see if any of them were sweet metals too. It wasn't difficult to find a sergeant in Boston. This had been his city when he was in the States. He'd painted the murals on the ceilings of the MFA and the walls of the public library. Harvard's Fogg Museum and the Massachusetts Historical Society had portraits of movers and shakers. The Peabody Essex, the Addison, and the Worcester had more portraits, many watercolors, many, many sketches. She saw pieces she'd copied before, like his splendid and somewhat eerie Daughters of Edward Darley Boyd at the MFA, and so many others her fingers itched to copy, like a facile watercolor of alligators at the Worcester. She saw dozens upon dozens of his works. Several of them gave her the general feeling of a sweet metal, but only three felt strong enough to actually be useful to a dream in need of energy. El Haleo, Boyd's Daughters, and an only recently discovered painting, a dramatic nude of Thomas McKellar, the black man sergeant used as his primary model for his MFA murals. The latter had been hidden away in Sargent's private collection for years, and his real relationship to the man in the painting remained so. She was no closer to understanding how sweet metals worked, and if anyone knew anything about them, they weren't talking to her.
"Several of the Monets are sweet metals," Jordan said, "at the MFA.
"Water lilies?" Declan suggested.
"One of the cathedrals, if you can believe it. The lilies gave me nothing at all."
Her first theory had been that a piece's sweet metal value was linked to its artistic merit, but she'd had to abandon it for lack of evidence. Several of the pieces that felt the strongest to Jordan at the Boudicca demonstration were the least artistically accomplished, after all, and there were many masterpieces that left her cold in the sweet metal department. Her next theory? She had no next theory. She decided her next step was to do a deep dive into the backgrounds of each of the sweet metals she found to see if there were clues there. But then Declan had invited her on this boat ride. Boat ride. It was a fine distraction, she told herself. She shouldn't let herself feel hurried by Boudicca's timeline, by Hennessy's silence.
"Have you thought about stealing one?" Declan asked casually.
Not from the gardener, but from somewhere.
"Of course."
"Which?"
"Easiest would be nicking one like Sherry Lamb's, but it hardly seems worth a crime, does it? It's not got a lot of oomph to it. If I stole one, I'd go big."
He leaned the wheel to the left, sending them deeper into the harbor.
"Tell me how you'd do it. Blue sky thinking."
Jordan ducked under his arm on the wheel in order to sit on his lap. He matter-of-factly sorted out her voluminous ponytail as she leaned her head back on his chest to gaze up at the shifting evening sky. He bent his head prayerfully, eyes still on their destination. Now mouths and ears were close enough for speaking at regular volume in this fast-moving boat. "The provenance game always makes the most sense to me." Provenance was the real work of a forger, the show-your-work of the art world. Beauty was nothing without bloodline. Creating the art in the style of a master was only the first step. Then came paperwork and research, fastidious work that began and ended with a story. A forged piece couldn't just spring into being. No one would believe one had suddenly found a new Monet, a new Cassatt, a new whatever it was. An alibi had to be invented, proven, knit into truth. Where had it been all these years? The more desirable the work, the better the story had to be. Hidden in a recluse's private collection, misattributed for years by bumpkins, discovered in a hidden basement after a house fire. But one could not just invent reclusive collectors or uncertain bumpkins or hidden basements. The forger had to find ones that already existed and slide the story in, making as small an incision in the truth as possible in order to promote unscarred healing to the timeline. Sometimes, depending on the buyer, this was as simple as including a news clipping of a recent manor house fire. For good museums or discerning buyers, bills of sale or insurance claims for stolen works, or letters from contemporaries mentioning the work, or photographs of the work next to relatives of the artist sometimes needed to be forged. Provenance. The crux of it, the crux of the plan, Jordan said, would be convincing the museum what they already had on their wall was a forgery, had been a forgery all along. Probably I'd get a slick young fellow with good teeth to convince them the original was swapped at some prior time, ideally before their tenure, so no hard feelings. I'd pick a year before it had got the hardest scientific evidence, the most scrutiny, all that noodly stuff that would make it tricky to forge, before it was x-rayed. Lead soap damage analysis, all that. I'd convince them all the things they'd been studying and writing up in their academic papers were actually attributes of the forgery, that the original has entirely different layers and damage. Declan had followed along beautifully. He said, "You'd need a whipping boy." Of course. She was always surprised by how well he knew this sideways world. He just didn't seem to fit the part. She supposed that had been the point of his camouflage all along. Look like a man who takes his dates to cheesy tourist attractions. Be a man who steals paintings. You'd have to place the blame for the first theft on someone who is currently there or stands to suffer from it. Then you'd sweep in with your original, Declan said, and tell them you're willing to secretly swap it for the forgery on display and let their negligence stay secret too if they help you. You've got it. The Dark Lady play. He didn't sound sore that the theft of his mother's portrait had been what brought them together in the first place. But you don't want to do that. I don't understand how to live that way, Jordan said. I can't carry around, like, a famous painting while I go about my day in order. I'd be trapped in the same room as it. A painting. A whole painting. Could I cut it into little pieces? She felt Declan's body recoil at the prospect. There'd be no way to find out until you ruined the thing you just worked very hard to steal. And could I live with knowing I'd chopped up a sergeant? Not bloody likely. She shifted her head on his chest. He tilted his chin. She felt his breath suck in. "The very concept gives me indigestion," Declan said. Then he twitched his shoulder to tell her to move. "I need to steer us in. We're there. Tie us off, can you?" To her surprise, they were not at a scenic point or romantic destination. They were at a private pier attached to a development of very choice row houses jutting directly out onto the harbor. "Matthew, the painting," Declan said. "Please don't drop it in the water." "What's all this?" Jordan asked as Matthew trundled gingerly up toward them with a parcel and very familiar wrapping. "The Dark Lady. The dreamt portrait of Declan's birth mother, Morakora, invested with the magical property of making whoever slept under the same roof as a dream of the sea. The dreamt portrait Jordan had once forged and once stolen and once returned." Declan held out a hand to help her step from the rocking boat onto the pier. "I told you I was going to show you a good time, didn't I?" Three exceptionally blonde people had emerged from one of the houses, a man, a woman, and a teenager, all of them dressed for the weather, each carrying or dragging a piece of luggage. They started down the pier toward a boat rather larger than the one Declan, Jordan, and Matthew had arrived in, but when the man caught sight of Declan, he stopped. "All right, Cody," the man told the teen, voice raised as he rummaged out a set of keys and dangled them. "Take that painting from him and put it just inside, would you? By the other things to go out. Lock the door after you. Lock it. Check it this time, please." The teen sulked up to Declan, took the painting of Declan's mother, and jogged it back to the house as the couple joined Declan, Jordan, and Matthew.
I'm going to go get the stuff situated, said the woman, smiling politely but continuing down the pier.
Be there in a minute, the man said. He and Declan shook hands casually, lightly, and then, politely, he shook with Jordan as well.
He offered a hand to Matthew, too, but Matthew had turned at just that moment to crouch and look over the edge at the water.
Sorry for the short notice, the man continued.
There was no problem, Declan said. Good way to escape the traffic.
It seems silly to me this can't be done over email or phone, but this is tradition, and I'm not going to be the first to break it. You know what I mean?
The man said.
What do you want to know?
Instead of answering, Declan said, Jordan, Miggle was on the MFA board for
15 years.
15 years, Declan agreed. He has dealt with several sweet metals. Jordan looked at Declan instead of at Miggle. A boat ride. A fine, pretty boat ride.
There's quite a bit of legend around them,
Miggle went on.
I don't want to say a secret society because that makes it seem organized, and it really isn't. It is more that anyone who deals in much art quickly learns to tell what is good art and what isn't, what is going to make a splash, what isn't. You get that sense in your head for what is worth your time, and it is not hard to tell after a while of dealing with art, high-end art, that some of them are these sweet metals. They are special, you know. People like them. They have that something. They sell for much more than you would think because of that something. So it pays to keep your eye out for it. But they are an open secret. You don't really talk about them. You wouldn't advertise something as a sweet metal. It's, what's the word? Gauche. The mystery is part of what makes them what they are. There's just a tradition of not putting anything about them in writing, if you can help it. And if you do, burn it. It's all very Ouija board. What do you want to know? Declan held his hand out to Jordan, the universal gesture for after you. How are they made? Jordan asked. How is it put into them? Do you know? Miggle squinted as if the question wasn't exactly logical to him, but then he answered slowly. Oh, I see what you are saying. The artist does it. It is something about how they are feeling when they make the art. I thought when I first saw one that it was because the art was special to the world in some way. A real original, you know. But it was explained to me later, and this makes more sense. They are special to the artist in some way. They are an original for the artist, something new for them, something personal for them. The subject matter, sometimes, how they felt when they were painting it others. This is what seems to make some of them into sweet metals. I do not think it is the artist who does it. It is like the spirit of the time. There is a French term for that, isn't there? There is a French term for everything. Does that answer the question? Declan looked to Jordan to see if it did. And you don't know what this is, what the specific bit is about the artist's process that does it, she said. You don't know anything more specific about this spirit of the time. All I know is that artists who produce sweet metals don't always make sweet metals, he said. They can make two in a row, maybe, and then none for the rest of time. Now, most of them are in private hands. But you know there are a few in the city, right? Open to the public? El Haleo, Declan said. Yes, Miko said. Sargent was good at them, but I suppose he was very prolific too, wasn't he? Have you ever seen his Madame X? Of course she had. Of course. Madame X was Sargent's self-proclaimed masterpiece with all its checkered history. It was one of the first Sargents Jordan had ever tried to copy. She and Hennessy had taken turns at it, sometimes even working on the same copy as they did it over and over again. There was a full-length copy of it back in the McLean mansion with a bunch of bullet holes in its head.
just like the poor girls who might still be there too. Miggle saw from their expressions they had.
It's a sweet metal too, off the charts.
Whatever those two have in common, that's what makes a sweet metal. His teen son jogged up to give Miggle his house keys. He'd locked away the portrait of Declan's mother safely inside the house.
Thank you for making the time before your trip, Declan said.
Thank you for facilitating, Miggle replied. I'm sure we'll be in touch again. That text number is good for you, right?
Handshakes were exchanged again. More murmured pleasantries, and then finally Declan, Jordan, and Matthew were left standing on the pier. The wind whipped at them. The masts behind them were skeletons. The pretty evening was turning into something even more feral.
It's kind of weird that water shows you your own face, Matthew said, but in an absent way.
Jordan said, that was the painting of your mother.
Yes, Declan said. It still is. I just don't have it anymore.
You traded it for this information?
Yes.
They studied each other.
He looked less ordinary as the sun disappeared and deepened the shadows beneath his eyebrows, obscuring the shape of his eyes, his expression.
This was a good time, Patsy, she told him.
Declan turned his face into the wind so that the darkness would hide his smile from her. He said, I expect great things from my portrait.